Prices shift, petrol jumps, shares fall. A company cuts jobs, and suddenly the business story is everyone's story.
I'm Alan Kohler.
And I'm Carrington Clark. From Monday to Thursday on ABC Business Daily, we break down the biggest stories in business, finance, and the economy, and why they matter.
Then on Fridays, I'll go deeper on That's Business, with the people making decisions, taking risks, and shaping where the economy goes next.
Find it all in the ABC Business Daily feed on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
From Gadigal Country, I'm Brooke Young, and today on The Breakfast Wrap, a strong warning from Australia's domestic spy agency as it delivers its annual threat assessment.
I do worry that one day an Australian will be killed at the hands of a foreign government here in Australia.
You'll hear from the boss of ASIO, Mike Burgess. Meanwhile, in Canberra, is a new political party on the horizon.
We are still focused on our core pillars around sensible economic management, climate action, integrity, equality.
Teal independents Sally Steggall and Allegra Spender are on the show for their first broadcast together as they form their party, Community Strong Australia. And overseas, what does the International Atomic Energy Agency know about the location of Iran's enriched uranium?
Iran does not want the IAEA to go there and issue a report on the basis of which they could be bombed again with whatever is left.
You'll hear from a former senior official at the IAEA. All that and much more coming up from the Radio National Breakfast team. This is The Breakfast Wrap. It certainly was a very busy news morning on Radio National Breakfast. But let's begin with what was a rather dire message from Australia's domestic intelligence agency, ASIO, last night.
Australia's terrorism threat level remains at probable, but I don't believe the system was designed for a situation like the one we face now. Probable does not tell the full story.
So ASIO has delivered its annual threat assessment, warning that the country faces a, quote, unprecedented number of threats. So in that speech, the spy agency's Director General, Mike Burgess, said that 31 major terrorism plots have been foiled since 2014. Now, this is the first threat assessment since the Bondi terror attack, which left 15 people dead. And another point in last night's speech was that 14, quote, significant terror-related cases have been successfully resolved since that attack in December. Mike Burgess was in the Parliament House studio this morning. And given he'd said that this probable threat level wasn't the full story, Sally asked him,
what is the full story?
Probable means a greater than 50% chance that in the next 12 months someone will advocate or undertake an act of terror. The problem with the level is the next level up is expected, so we and the police need intelligence that says someone is about to undertake an attack. Of course, the level would go up, but at that point police would be going to the front door to stop that attack. I'm concerned about the temperature and trajectory. So within the band of probable, the increase for violence has actually happened and is happening, and that concerns me. So I'm worried that probable by itself does not send the message to all of us that need to know what the threat that we're facing.
You said, quote, I do worry that one day an Australian will be killed at the hands of a foreign government here in Australia. Are you talking about potential civilian casualties, or do you mean a targeted killing?
Targeted killing, but that could be civilian. That could be a prominent Australian that is killed, or everyday Australians just about going about their business. So I am really concerned about the actions of some nation states, Iran in particular, and the level they will go to. That's why we describe our security environment as degraded, because some nation states will plumb the depths and go to extreme levels that we would find unacceptable and horrible.
How does the current situation compare to what you've seen previously in your long career in this area?
Well, nation states doing bad things like that is not new, but in Australia it's not common, is it? So, and at this point in time with a dynamic, diverse, integrated security environment, we are really concerned about this.
14 terror-related cases have been, quote, successfully resolved since the Bondi terror attack in December last year. What can you say about those incidents? Were they plots for a deadly attack on Australians?
So as I said last night in my remarks, 31 major plots foiled, so that's major terror plots. The 14 events dealt with since Bondi are not major plots disrupted. One of them was, but of course they are still caught in their early stage, but actually if not found and checked, it could have led to a mass casualty event, and obviously that's bad.
In April, in its interim report, the Royal Commission on Antisemitism and Social Cohesion found, despite an overall increase in funding to intelligence agencies, the proportion of funding allocated to counter-terrorism significantly declined from 2020 to 2025. Was ASIO funding sufficient to deal with the threats being confronted before the Bondi attack in December?
So a couple of points I'd make there. One, there's a Royal Commission, so I've given my evidence both in public and classified, so I'll refrain from any other comments other than to say and repeat what I said last night. For ASIO, we increased our resources on counter-terrorism when we raised the threat level in August 24, and we increased in the months before Bondi.
When you delivered your threat assessment in February last year, you said you were concerned that anti-Semitic attacks had not yet plateaued. What's your sense of the situation now?
It's still a very real threat, and of course that concerns us. But more broadly, with the terrorism threat level at probable and the temperature increased, that threat faces all Australians, not just Jewish Australians, unfortunately.
Last night you revealed that the firebombing of the Adas Israel synagogue in Melbourne in December was directed by a former Australian resident living in Iraq and recruited by Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. How concerned are you by the threat of Iranian state-sponsored terrorism in Australia?
That is a pressing and ongoing concern. Earlier this year in Europe, Iran-backed groups conducted attacks in Europe, and we're concerned that those operations will expand into this region, including Australia, and that could result in more arsons and even death of Australians.
Has the war and the leadership change in Iran changed that threat level at all?
The war has added to the frustrations and anger in society. That's just part of the problem that we have. It's okay to feel strong emotions about what's going on anywhere in the world. It's okay to protest. But how we protest or what we do with those feelings really does matter, and that puts pressure on our environment where the chances of politically motivated violence are higher today than they were a year ago.
Why is the overall threat situation so significant at the moment? What's driving all of this across the board, do you think?
Oh, there's a number of drivers behind this, and not one single ideology. And there's something else that's gone on in society where we're quick to anger. We don't debate. The level of tolerance is not what it used to be. I had some remarks in my speech last night of a fair go for all, the value of mutual trust and tolerance and respect. If people just took the heat out of the debate, by all means protest, but be careful how you protest. For the media, certainly continue to do your job, but be careful how you do your job. For any of us, including myself.
How?
Well, you know, the clickbait model of media these days, no offence to anyone, but those headlines drive anger. And actually, when you see people get angry, there is a direct correlation in these modern times between anger and language, inflamed tension and violence.
What's your message overall to Australians who are digesting your threat assessment, not only for their own lives, but for their kids, the way they work, the way they live? What's the message to ordinary Australians?
Yes, so there are, obviously it's important that people understand the threats we face. Security is a shared responsibility, and when you're informed, you're able to make informed decisions. I'd also say that whilst it's a kind of a not upbeat bedtime reading, the threat assessment, I think Australians should still have confidence in our ability to respond, but it requires all of us to press into these issues so we can manage our risk and make Australia a safer place to live.
That's Mike Burgess, Director General of ASIO, speaking there with Sally Sara in Canberra on Radio National Breakfast. The Parliament House studio was a bit of a revolving door this morning, because shortly after, Sally was joined by Teal Independence, Zali Steggall and Allegra Spender, who are coming together to form a new political party. It's called Community Strong Australia. And it's the first time there's been a formal alliance between any of the so-called Teals elected to Parliament. But as of yet, none of the other Teals have joined, and the party is yet to reveal any candidates, policies, or even a leader. Now, both MPs, Zali Steggall and Allegra Spender, joined the program for their first broadcast together as a party. And it was Zali Steggall who answered the initial question of why now?
I think Australia is at a crossroads politically where many people in our communities feel really unheard and feel that the major parties are out of touch, excuse me, but also are worried about the growing level of disunity and anger and some of the very divisive rhetoric that comes out of politicians in this place. And they're looking for how do we have solutions rather than just slogans, right? And how do we actually come together to form good policies that bring communities to the heart of decision making?
So how do you, Allegra Spender, how do you maintain the integrity of being an independent, which is the way in which you were elected, but also have this party structure?
So I think this is a really different type of party, I think, than any of the ones that we've ever had here in Australia, because one of the key premises is a free vote, because that's what people really are asking for, is they do want politicians to put their communities first. But at the same time, people want us to work collaboratively together and be practical and pragmatic. And what we can do by setting up this party is we can actually support people in and candidates who otherwise wouldn't be able to be supported. You know, for instance, in the Senate, you actually have to have a party to run effectively in the Senate, but also for those people in communities where, you know, they may feel that they're never going to get an independent, but they would like to be able to back people who they and get involved in a movement where they think they can create real change. And this is a way that people can do that.
So where will this party sit on the political spectrum? Some people see the spectrum as this, others as that. where do you sit? Is this progressive liberal kind of views, or where do you sit?
It will be very centrist. And I think for our communities, it's important to understand our commitment to our communities has not changed. We are still focused on our core pillars, pillars around sensible economic management, climate action, integrity, equality. They are the heart of what Community Strong is about. And so I think it's always very hard when we try and define that from a left and right perspective. We miss a lot with that kind of categorisation. For many people going about their lives, they want decisions made in this place that actually start helping their lives, support them when times are tough, give them that opportunity to prosper and thrive. And they feel like often decisions made by career politicians and governments are too run by ideology, vested interests, power brokers behind the scenes, and communities aren't at the forefront of those decision making. So in terms of that spectrum, it's very centrist. It's actually about being focused and committed to values and those core policy commitments.
And also, I would like to add, it's about also the process, because I think what we've done as independents is really, you know, work with experts and work with community on policy. And I think that's what people are really looking for. But, you know, there are a lot of people who are politically homeless. I've had a few texts this morning saying, you know, if you're someone who's, you know, business focused, really driving innovation, but you also support climate action, where do you go? You know, you have no home. And so I think this is an opportunity for people, you know, who have a range of views, because most Australians aren't particularly ideological. They just want the country to work. They want to feel like they are connected. They want, you know, they want cohesion. They want prosperity. And, you know, but they also want fairness. And it is that balance that I think we're seeking, and that's balance we're trying to represent.
So I guess one of the key questions, you're right in front of me here in the studio, raise your hand. Who is the leader of this party?
There is no leader of this party.
Think of it as a sporting team, if you will.
Team has a captain.
Well, but again, there is no capacity to deliver a performance without everyone pulling their weight and everything doing well. I think we all bring different skills and attributes to the table. And I think there are many people out there in communities that have so much to offer, but the current political system and status quo does not give them an opportunity to participate. So I think it's a bit of a media construct of always thinking about leadership and power. This is not about that. This is about having more voices at the table so we can have better policies and better outcomes.
And the constitution of the party basically says, you know, until there are sort of 10, you know, 10 sort of members, or which effectively your members are senators or and members of parliament, you know, we're not going to put in this sort of leadership structure. That may evolve over time, but really, like, we're starting together and we really want to build it from the ground up. I mean, one of the big things right now is, you know, we put out this our constitution, but we do want to get feedback, particularly from the communities that, you know, we represent, because it is really important that this represents a different type of politics, because that's what people are frustrated with.
Who's paying for this? Where's the funding coming from for this party?
I urge everyone listening, if you want to be at the table, Community Strong is funded through donation. No, Climate 200 is not involved. They have done amazing work within the community independent movement, but remain focused on that independent representation within those communities. The funding is, again, going to need to be built from the ground up.
Mike Cannon-Brookes or Scott Farquhar?
Well, remember, At the moment, communities are at a huge disadvantage compared to the political parties. We know the majors did a stitch-up when it came to donation reform laws in the last parliament to ensure they could really freeze out competition.
Just finally, would you be open to accepting any disaffected moderate liberals?
Look, I think we are trying to build a broad church of people, but I think they have to be really aligned to the values, and they also have to be really connected to community, because that's where we've come from, and I think that has really been missing from the major parties. So, you know, we've both worked very effectively, I think, across the parliament with people from all sorts of, sort of political lives, open to it, but, you know.
Would you have a party position on issues? You're allowed to cross the floor?
It's a free vote, so we will each consult with our communities and encourage communities to give feedback. There's the formation of a community engagement committee so that communities that don't currently have an MP that represents their views have that opportunity to join Community Strong and be part of it.
Federal Member for Wentworth, Allegra Spender, and Federal Member for Warringah, Zali Stegall, speaking there with Sally Sara in their first broadcast since announcing their new political party. Well, political correspondent Tom Crowley was waiting in the wings to unpack this latest news, and he certainly had quite a bit of analysis to lay down.
That was one of the more interesting interview dynamics that in the short time I've been sitting in this studio that I've seen. It's just interesting to see two leaders, how they divvy up answering the questions there. I think we heard a little more from Zali Stegall than Allegra Spender.
Are they on the same page?
We will see. This is one of the things that political parties do, whether they have leaders or not. There are always disagreements about the way forward. I have to say, it was a few weeks ago when both Zali Stegall and Allegra Spender on the same day responded to reports speculating about a party, both of them saying, yes, I have been in conversations. No, they're not final yet. I think on that morning, it didn't really seem like they were, well, they weren't appearing together for one thing in the media interviews or saying necessarily that they were going to do it together. They just had slightly different ways, I think, of talking about it that morning. And it was Zali Stegall who really embraced the alternative to the major parties. Allegra Spender probably has always been seen as a little bit closer to the Liberal Party in general, closer to Malcolm Turnbull, and I suppose seen more as, I mean, it's often just, I guess to put it this way, within the Liberal Party, people always talk about Allegra Spender, particularly as moderates, saying essentially they wish that she was one of them, that she could be a shadow treasurer if she were around now, and she's the kind of person that might be a candidate to lead the Liberal Party had that been the path that she'd chosen. And had the party been one that she felt that she could join. They don't say that about Zali Stegall, who's a different kind of political operator, and probably, we talk about political spectrums, probably is more to the left of Allegra Spender. So that can, you know, they are obviously trying to break out of those sorts of binaries and to collaborate, and they do obviously find a lot of common ground and work together as a larger bloc in the parliament. So it's a pragmatic thing, clearly, to be able to access the kind of funding that parties can have under the new electoral funding laws that Don Farrell passed. And Don Farrell was unapologetic when he passed those laws that the Teals could form a party if they wanted to do so and they
in
could get all of those
studio
benefits. Yeah, nothing too nefarious about it the way that he sees it. And Climate 200, which they were very quick to distance, and I think Allegra Spender, she just sort of briefly just peppered in a couple of no, we didn't speak to Climate 200. Or Scott Farquhar. So in case you missed it, she was pretty declarative about that. But, you know, they have given support to independents across the country and often large sums of money, and some of those wealthy donors have given to a few different candidates. The mechanism of a party would allow them to continue to do that if they wish, not to say that they're necessarily then involved in the formation, but it just makes all of that possible in this new world. You know, so many questions about exactly what this would look like, but the desire for something in the centre, clearly the driver here.
That's Tom Crowley, political correspondent. Well, let's head over to the Middle East, where there's certainly no shortage of political debate. And there's some fierce arguments going on at the moment over whether Iran will allow inspections of its most sensitive nuclear sites. So earlier in the week, Iran said that it had not permitted inspectors from the International Atomic Energy Agency to access sites. But US President Donald Trump hit back on social media, claiming that Iran had, quote, fully and completely agreed to the highest level nuclear inspections during negotiations in Switzerland, and that any claims otherwise were false. So the head of the IAEA, Rafael Grossi, had to weigh in yesterday to clear things up, and he reiterated that his inspectors will visit the country's nuclear enrichment sites. Well, Tarek Rauf is the former head of nuclear verification and security policy coordination at the IAEA, and he joined the program to explain where these conflicting claims between the US and Iran are coming from.
IAEA inspectors are already in Iran inspecting some of the sites that were not bombed, like the Bushehr nuclear power plant and the Tehran research reactor. But Iran's statements coming before and after the Lucerne Lake summit meeting state that they will not allow the IAEA to go to any of the bombed facilities, which includes the three enrichment plants.
And what's the reason behind that? Is that sensitivity around showing how damaged or not those sites are?
Well, we can see from satellite imagery what the damage is. So it's quite severe, and the IAEA Director General in some of his comments to the media has said that based on examining satellite imagery, the sites are heavily damaged. But my view is that Iran does not want the IAEA to go there and issue a report on the basis of which they could be bombed again with whatever is left. So I think that is one sensitivity. But secondly, the sites are really unsafe because the tunnel entrances have been bombed. So somebody would have to go and excavate them in order to provide access to the underground halls. And not all the bombs that were dropped exploded. So it also presents a safety and security risk. So one would need some military personnel who have experience in removing unexploded ordnance.
And what do we know about the amount and the location of Iran's enriched material?
Well, we know everything about the quantity of the nuclear material. So the reports that the IAEA issued last year in May and then again in September said very clearly that the last inspection at Natanz and Fordo was carried out on the 11th of June, 2025. And the Israeli bombing started on the 12th of June. So as of the 11th of June last year, Iran had roughly 9,428 kilograms of enriched uranium across four levels, 2%, 5%, 20%, and 60%. And the 60% complement amounted to 440.9 kilograms. So that is the material of the highest concern.
Do we know the location of that material of highest concern?
Well, we knew what the location was, or the IAEA knew what the location was on the 11th of June. But on the 12th of June, Iran sent a letter to the IAEA that it would be moving this material to locations in order to, for the security of the material, and would inform the IAEA later. But to date, the Iranians have not informed the IAEA if and where the material was relocated.
And Tarek, that material that is at 60%, what more would need to happen to that material to have it go to weapons grade?
Yes, it would need to be further enriched to 90 to 97%. Then a lot of engineering work needs to be done to convert the uranium hexafluoride gas into uranium metal. Those disks have to be machined. And then a whole bunch of other non-nuclear components have to be put together, like the fusing and so on. So according to estimates by the Israeli intelligence and the United States intelligence in March of last year and later, stated that it would take Iran at least 1 year once a decision had been authorized to make nuclear weapons, and there was no evidence that such a decision had been authorized by the late Supreme Leader.
That's Tarek Rauf, former head of Nuclear Verification and Security Policy Coordination at the IAEA. And that's all for this very busy episode of The Breakfast Wrap. All interviews were done by Sally Sara and produced by the Radio National Breakfast team. This episode of The Breakfast Wrap was produced by Oscar Coleman. I'm Brooke Young. Catch you tomorrow.